Chapter 15. People will not know the guilt they cannot deny, cannot escape. Blind the gods and fix their scales with binding chains and pull them down like the truths we hate. We puzzle over the bones of strangers and wonder at the world when they danced free of us, blessedly long ago, and we are different now. But even to speak of the men and women we were then tempts the whirlwind ghosts of our victims, and this will not do as we treasure the calm and the smooth of pretend. What cruel weapons of nature and time struck down all these strangers of long ago, when we were witness in a hapless, if smug, way. We dodged the spear thrusts of mischance, where they stumbled, too oafish, too clumsy, and altogether inferior, and their bones you will find in mountain caves and river clay, in white spider crevasses above white beaches, in forest shelters of rock, and all the places in between, so many that one slayer, we say, cannot be responsible. But many the weapons of nature, and the skittish thing in our eyes as they slide away, perhaps mutters to a sharp ear, the one constant shadow behind all those deaths. Why, that would be us, silent in guilt, undeserving recipients of the solitary gift that leaves us nothing but the bones of strangers to tumble and roll beneath our arguments. They are wordless in repose, but still unwelcome, for they speak as only bones can, and still we will not listen. Show me the bones of strangers, and I become disconsolate. Unwelcome Lament, Gadesp, First Empire. He saw a different past, one that rolled out after choices not made. He saw the familiar trapped inside strangeness, huddling round fires as winds howled and new things moved in the darkness beyond. The failure of opportunities haunted him and his kind. A dogged rival slipped serpent-like into the mossy cathedrals of needled forests, sliding along shadow streams, and life became a time of picking through long-dead kills, frowning at broken tools of stone different from anything ever seen before. This, all of this, he realized, was the slow failure that, in his own past, had been evaded. By the ritual of Telan, the sealing of living souls inside lifeless bone and flesh, the trapping of sparks inside withered eyes. Here, in this other past, in that other place, there had been no ritual, and the ice that was in his own realm the plaything of the Jaghut here lifted barriers unbidden. Everywhere the world shrank. Of course such challenges had been faced before. People suffered, many died, but they struggled through and they survived. This time, however, it was different. This time there were strangers. He did not know why he was being shown this. Some absurdly detailed false history to torment him? Too elaborate, too strained in its conceptualization. He had real wounds that could be torn open. Yes, the vision mocked him, but on a scale broader than that of his own personal failures. He was being shown the inherent weakness of his own kind. He was feeling the feelings of those last survivors in that other bitter world, the muddy knowledge of things coming to an end, the end of families, the end of friends, the end of children, nothing to follow. The end, in fact, of the one thing never before questioned.
Continuation. We tell ourselves that each of us must pass, but that our kind will live on. This is the deeply buried taproot feeding our very will to live. Cut that root, and living fades. Bleeding dry and colorless, it fades.
He was invited to weep one last time, to weep not for himself, but for his species.
When fell the last salty tear of the Imas? Did the soil that received it taste its difference from all those that came before? Was it bitterer? Was it sweeter? Did it sting the ground like acid?
He could see that tear, its deathly drop dragged into infinity, a journey too slow to measure. but he knew that what he was seeing was a conceit. The last to die had been dry-eyed. Onos Tulan had witnessed the moment here in this false past, the wretched brave lying bound and bleeding and awaiting the flint-toothed ivory blade in a stranger's hand. They too were hungry, desperate, those strangers. And they would kill the Imas, the last of his kind, and they would eat him, leave his cracked and cut bones scattered on the floor of this cave, with all the others, and then, in sudden superstitious terror, the strangers would flee this place, leaving nothing behind of themselves, lest wronged ghosts find them on the paths of haunting. In that other world, the end of Tul's kind came at the cut of a knife. Someone was howling, flesh stretched to bursting by a surge of rage. The children of the Imas, who were not children at all, but inheritors nevertheless, had flooded the world with the taste of Imas blood on their tongues. Just one more quarry hunted into oblivion, with nothing more than a vague unease lodged deep inside, the mark of sin, the horror of a first crime.
The son devours the father, heart of a thousand myths, a thousand half-forgotten tales.
Empathy was excoriated from him. The howl he heard was rising from his own throat. The rage battered like fists inside his body, a demonic thing eager to get out.
They will pay.
But no. Onos Tulan staggered onward, hide-bound feet crunching on frozen moss and lichen. He would walk out of this damning, vicious fate, back to his own world's paradise beyond death, where rituals delivered curse and salvation both. He would not turn. He was blind as a beast driven to the cliff's edge, but it did not matter. What awaited him was a death better than this death. He saw a rider ahead, a figure hunched and cowled as it waited astride a gaunt grey horse from which no breath plumed. He saw a recurved rivy bow gripped in one bony hand, and Onos Tulan realized that he knew this rider, this inheritor. Tul halted 20 paces away.
You cannot be here.
The head tilted slightly, and the glitter of a single eye broke the blackness beneath the cowl.
Nor you, old friend, yet here we are. Move aside, talk the younger. Let me pass. What waits beyond is what I have earned. What I will return to, it is mine. I will see the herds again, the great eye and the Ranak, the Okral and Agkor. I will see my kin and run in the shadow of the tusked Tenag. I will throw a laughing child upon my knee. I will show the children their future and tell them how all that we are shall continue unending. For here I will find an eternity of wishes forever fulfilled. Talk, my friend. Do not take this from me. Do not take this, too, when you and your kind have taken everything else.
I cannot let you pass, Tul.
Tul's scarred, battered hands closed into fists.
For the love between us, talk the younger, do not do this.
An arrow appeared in Tok's other hand, biting the bowstring, and, faster than Tul could register, the barbed missile flashed out and stabbed the ground at his feet.
I am dead, said Tul. You cannot hurt me.
We're both dead,
Tok replied, his voice cold as a stranger's.
I will take your legs out from under you, and the wounds will be real. I will leave you bleeding, crippled, in terrible pain. You will not pass.
Tul took a step forward.
Why? The rage burns bright within you, doesn't it? Abyss, take it. I am done with fighting. I am done with all of it.
On my tongue, Onos Tulan, is the taste of Imas blood.
You want me to fight you? I will. Do you imagine your puny arrows can take down an Imas? I have snapped the neck of a bull, Ranag. I have been gored, mauled by an Okral. When my kind hunt, we bring down our quarry with our own hands,
and that triumph is purchased in broken bones and pain."
A second arrow thudded into the ground.
"Tok, why are you doing this?"
"You must not pass.
I gifted you with an Imas name. Did you not realize the measure of that honor? Did you not know that no other of your kind has ever been given such a thing? I called you friend. When you died, I wept."
"I see you now, in flesh, all that once rode the bone.
You have seen this before, Tok the Younger."
"I do not.
You did not recognize me. Outside the walls of Black Coral, I found you, but even your face was not your own. We were changed, the both of us. Could I go back?"
He faltered and then continued.
"Could I go back, I would not have let you pass me by. I would have made you realize. It does not matter."
Something broke inside Onos Tulan. He looked away.
"No, perhaps it doesn't.
On the Aldan plain, you saw me fall." Tul staggered back as if struck a blow.
"I did not know."
"Nor me, Tul. And so truths come round, full circle, with all the elegance of a curse. I did not know you outside Black Coral. You did not know me on the plain. Fates have a way of fitting together."
Tok paused and then hissed a bitter laugh.
"And do you recall when we met at the foot of Morn? Look upon us now. I am the withered corpse, and you..."
He seemed to tremble, as if struck an invisible blow, and then recovered.
"On the plain, Onos Tulan, what did I give my life for? Do you recall?"
The bitterness in Tul's mouth was unbearable. He wanted to shriek. He wanted to tear out his own eyes.
"The lives of children.
Can you do the same?"
Deeper than any arrows, Tok struck with his terrible words.
"You know I cannot,"
Tul said in a rasp.
"You will not, you mean?"
"They are not my children."
"You have found the rage of the Imas, the rage they escaped, Tul, with the ritual. You have seen the truth of other pasts, and now you would flee it all. Do you really believe, Onos Tulan, that you will find peace? Peace in self-deception? This world behind me, the one you so seek, you will infect with the lies you tell yourself. Every child's laugh will sound hollow, and the look in every beast's eye will tell you they see you truly."
The third arrow struck his left shoulder, spun him round, but did not knock him down. Righting himself, Tul reached to grip the shaft. He snapped it and drew out the fletched end. Behind him, the flint point and a hand's width of shaft fell to the ground.
What do you want of me?"
"You must not pass.
What do you want?"
"I want nothing, Tul. I want nothing."
And he knocked another arrow.
"Then kill me."
"We're dead," Tok said. "That I cannot do. But I can stop you. Turn round, Onos Tulan. Go back."
"To what?"
Tok the Younger hesitated, as if uncertain for the first time in this brutal meeting.
"We are guilty," he said slowly, "of so many pasts. Will we ever be made to answer for any of them? I wait, you see, for the fates to fit together. I wait for the poisonous beauty."
"You want me to forgive you, your kind, Tok the Younger?"
"Once in the city of Mott, I wandered into a market and found myself in front of row upon row of squall apes, the swamp dwellers. I looked into their eyes, Tul, and I saw their suffering, their longing, their terrible crime of living. And for all that, I knew that they were simply not intelligent enough to refuse forgiveness. You, Imas, you are. So,
Do not forgive us. Never forgive us. Am I to be the weapon of your self-hatred? I wish I knew.
In those four words, Tool heard his friend, a man trapped, struggling to recall himself. Talk resumed.
After the ritual, well, you chose the wrong enemy for your endless war of vengeance. It would have been more just, don't you think, to proclaim a war against us humans? Perhaps one day, Silver Fox will come to realize that and choose for her undead armies a new enemy.
He then shrugged.
If I believed in justice, that is, if I imagined that she was capable of seeing clearly enough, that you and you alone, Tlani Mas, are in the position to take on the necessary act of retribution. For those squall apes, for all the so-called lesser creatures that have fallen and ever fall to our slick desires.
He speaks the words of the dead. His heart is cold. His single eye sees and does not shy away. He is tormented. Is this what you expected? Tool asked. When you died? What of Hood's gate?
Teeth gleamed.
Locked. How can that be?
The next arrow split his right kneecap. Bellowing in agony, Tool collapsed. He writhed, fire tearing up his leg. Pain, in so many layers, folding round and round. The wound, the murder of a friendship, the death of love, history skirling up in a plume of ashes. Horse hoofs slowly thumped closer. Blinking tears from his eyes, Tool stared up at the ravaged, half-rotted face of his old friend.
On us, Tulan, I am the lock.
The pain was overwhelming. He could not speak. Sweat stung his eyes, more bitter than any tears.
My friend, the one thing left in me, it is slain. You have murdered it.
Go back, said Tok in a tone of immeasurable weariness.
I cannot walk.
That will ease, once you turn around. Once you retrace your route, the farther you get away from me.
With blood-smeared hands, Tool prized loose the arrow jutting from his knee. He almost passed out in the wave of agony that followed and lay gasping.
Find your children, Onos Tulan. Not of the blood, of the spirit.
There are none, you bastard. As you said, you and your kind killed them all.
Weeping, he struggled to stand, twisting as he turned to face the way he had come. Rock-studded, rolling hills, a grey, lowering sky.
You've taken it all.
And we're far from finished, said Tok behind him.
I now cast away love. I embrace hate.
Tok said nothing to that. Dragging his maimed leg, Tool set out. Tok the Younger, who had once been Annister, firstborn of the Dead Seed, who had once been a Malazan soldier, one-eyed and a son to a vanished father, sat on his undead horse and watched the broken warrior limp to the distant range of hills. When, at long last, Tool edged over a ridge and then disappeared behind it, Tok dropped his gaze. His lone eye roved over the matted stains of blood on the dead grasses, the glistening arrows, one broken, the other not, and those jutting from the half-frozen earth. Arrows fashioned by Tool's own hands so long ago on a distant plain. He suddenly pitched forward, curling up like a gut-stabbed child. A moment later, a wretched sob broke loose. His body trembled, bones creaking in dried sockets as he wept, tearless, leaking nothing but the sounds pushing past his withered throat. A voice broke through from a few paces away.
Compelling you to such things, Herald, leaves me no pleasure.
Collecting himself with a groan, Tok the Younger straightened in the saddle and fixed his eye upon the ancient bonecaster standing now in the place where Tool had been. He bared dull, dry teeth.
Your hand was colder than Hood's own, witch. Do you imagine Hood is pleased at you stealing his herald? That you're using him as you will? This will not go unanswered.
I have no reason to fear Hood.
But you have reason to fear me, O Lar-Ethiel.
And how will you find me, Dead Rider? I stand here, yet not here. No, in the living world, I am huddled beneath furs, sleeping under bright stars.
You have no need of sleep, she laughed.
Guard it well by a young warrior. One you knew well, yes? One you chase at night, there behind his eyes. And yes, when I saw the truth of that, why, he proved my path to you. And you spoke to me, begging for his life, which I accepted into my care. It has all led to this.
And here, Tok muttered, I'd given up believing in evil. How many others do you plan to abuse?
As many as I need, Herald.
I will find you. When my other tasks are finally done, I swear I will find you.
To achieve what? Onostulan is severed from you, and more importantly, from your kind.
She paused and then added with a half snarl,
I don't know what you meant by that rubbish you managed to force out about Tul finding his children. I need him for other things.
I was fighting free of you, Bonecaster. He saw, he heard,
and failed to understand. Onostulan hates you now. Think on that. Think on the deepness of his love, and know that for an Imas, hatred runs deeper still. Ask the Jaghut. It is done, and can never be mended. Ride away from this, Herald. I now release you.
I look forward, said Tok, gathering the reins, to the next time we meet, O Lar-Ethiel.
Torrent's eyes snapped open. Stars in blurred, jade-tinged smears spun overhead. He drew a deep but ragged breath, shivered beneath his furs. O Lar-Ethiel's crackling voice cut through the darkness.
Did he catch you?
He was in no hurry to reply to that. Not this time. He could still smell the dry, musty aura of death, could still hear the drumbeat of hoofs. The witch continued.
Less than half the night is done. Sleep. I will keep him from you now.
He sat up.
Why would you do that, O Lar-Ethiel? Besides, he added, my dreams belong to me, not you.
Rasping laughter drifted across to him.
Do you see his lone eye? How it glitters in darkness like a star? Do you hear the howl of wolves echoing out from the empty pit of the one he lost? What do the beasts want with him? Perhaps he will tell you when at last he rides you down.
Torrent bit down one reply, chose another.
I escape. I always do, she grunted.
Good. He is filled with lies. He would use you as the dead are wont to do to mortals.
In the night, Torrent bared his teeth.
Like you?
Like me, yes. There is no reason to deny it. But listen well. I must leave your side for a time. Continue southward on your journey. I have awakened ancient springs. Your horse will find them. I will return to you.
What is it you want, O Lar-Ethiel? I am nothing. My people are gone. I wander without purpose, caring not if I live or die. And I will not serve you. Nothing you can say can compel me.
Do you believe me a tyrant? I am not. I am a bonecaster. Do you know what that is?
No, a witch.
Yes, that will do for a start. Tell me, do you know what a soul taken is? A divers?
No.
What do you know of elder gods?
Nothing.
He heard something like a snarl, and then she said,
How can your kind live, so steeped in ignorance? What is history to you, warrior of the Aldan? A host of lies to win you glory. Why do you so fear the truth of things? The darker moments of your past, you, your tribe, all of humanity. There were thousands of my people who did not join the ritual of Telan. What happened to them? Why, you did. No matter where they hid, you found them. Oh, on rare occasions there was breeding, a fell admixture of blood. But most of the time such meetings ended in slaughter. You saw in our faces the strange and the familiar. Which of the two frightened you the most? When you cut us down, when you carved the meat from our bones.
You speak nonsense, Torrance said. You tell me you are Imas, as if I should know what that means. I do not, nor do I care. Peoples die. They vanish from the world. It is as it was and ever will be.
You are a fool. From my ancient blood ran every stream of soul taken and divers. And my blood, it was but half Imas, perhaps even less. I am old beyond your imagining, warrior, older than this world. I lived in darkness. I walked in purest light. I cast curses upon shadow. My hands were chipped stone. My eyes spawned the first fires to huddle round. My legs spread to the first mortal child. I am known by so many names, even I have forgotten most of them.
She rose, her squat frame dangling rotted furs, her hair lifting like an aura of madness to surround her withered face, and advanced to stand over him. A sudden chill gripped Torrent. He could not move. He struggled to breathe. She spoke.
Parts of me sleep, tormented by sickness. Others rail in the fury of summer storms. I am the drinker of birth waters and blood, and the rain of weeping and the oil of ordeal. I did not lie, mortal, when I told you that the spirits you worship are my children. I am the bringer of a land's bounty. I am the cruel thief of want, the sower of suffering. So many names. Eran Ishal, mother to the Erasal, my first and most sentimental of choices.
She seemed to flinch.
Rath Evain to the Fokral Asael, Stone Bitch to the Jaghut. I have had a face in darkness, a son in shadow, a bastard in light. I have been named the Mother beneath the mountain, Ayala Alal, who tends the gardens of the moon, forever awaiting her lover. I am Burn, the sleeping goddess, in whose dreams life flowers unending, even as those dreams twist into nightmares. I am scattered to the very edge of the abyss, possessor of more faces than any other elder.
She snapped out a withered, bony hand, the nails long and splintered, and slowly curled her fingers.
And he thinks to hunt me down.
Her head tilted back to the sky.
Chain down your servant's hood.
She fixed him once more with her eyes.
Tell me, mortal, did he catch you?
Torrance stared up at her, an old hag crackling with venom and rage. Her dead breath reeked of serpents among the rocks. The onyx knuckles of her eyes glistened with the mockery of life.
"Perhaps," he said, "you were once all those things, Olar Ethiel. But not any more. It's all torn away from you, isn't it? Scattered and lost, when you gave up life, when you chose to become this thing of bones."
That hand lunged down, closed about his neck. He was lifted from the ground as if he weighed less than an orphan, flung away, slamming hard down on one shoulder, breath whooshing from his lungs, half-blinded and unable to move. She appeared above him, rotted teeth glittering like stumps of smoky quartz.
"I am promised! The stone bitch shall awaken once more, in plague winds and devouring locusts, in wildfires and drowning dust and sand. And you will fall upon each other, rending flesh with teeth and nails. You will choose evil in fullest knowledge of what you do. I am coming, mortal, the earth awakened to judgment. And you shall kneel, pleading, begging. Your kind, human, shall make pathos your epitaph. For I will give you nothing. Yield not a single instant of mercy."
She was gasping now, a pointless bellows of unwarmed breath. She trembled in terrible rage.
"Did he speak to you?"
Torrance sat up.
"No," he said through gritted teeth.
He reached up to the swollen bruises on his throat.
"Good."
And Olar Ethiel turned away.
"Sleep, then. You will awaken alone. But do not think you are rid of me. Do not think that."
A pause, and then,
"He is filled with lies. Beware him."
Torrent hunched forward, staring at the dew-speckled ground between his crooked legs. He closed his eyes.
"I will do as you ask. When the time comes, I will do as you ask."
She awoke to the howling of wolves. Setok slowly sat up, ran a hand through the tangles of her matted hair, and then drew her bedroll closer about her body. False dawn was ebbing, almost drowned out by the glare of the jade slashes. As the echoes of those howls faded, Setok cocked her head. Had something else stirred her awake? She could not be certain. The stillness of night embraced them. She glanced across to the motionless form of Kafal. She'd run him into exhaustion. Each night since they'd begun this journey, he'd fallen into deep sleep as soon as their paltry evening meal was done. As her eyes adjusted, she could make out his face. It had grown gaunt, aged by deprivation. She knew he'd not yet reached his 30th year of life, but he seemed decades older. He lay like a dead man, yet she sensed from him troubled dreams. He was desperate to return to his tribe.
"Something terrible is about to happen."
These words had ground out from him again and again, a litany of dread, a chant riding out his tortured breaths as he ran. She caught a scent, a sudden mustiness in the cool, dry air. Visions of strange fecundity fluttered across her eyes, as if the present was peeling away, revealing this landscape in ancient times. An oasis, a natural garden rich with color and life. Iridescent birds sang among palm fronds. Monkeys scampered, mouths stained with succulent fruit. A tiny world, but a complete one, seemingly changeless, untouched by her kind. When she saw the grey cloud drifting closer, inexplicable bleak despair struck her, and she gasped aloud. She saw the dust settling like rain, a dull patina coating the leaves, the globes of fruit, the once clear pool of water, and everything began to die. In moments, there was nothing but blackened rot, dripping down the boles of the palms. The monkeys, covered in oozing sores, their hair falling away, curled up and died. The birds sought to flee, but ended up on the grey ground, flapping and twitching, then falling still. The oasis dried up. The winds blew away what was left, and sands closed about the spring until it too vanished. Setok wept. What had done this? Some natural force? Did some mountain erupt to fill the sky with poison ash? Or was it a god's bitter breath? Had some wretched city burned, spewing acidic alchemies into the air? Was this desecration an accident, or was it deliberate? She had no answer to such questions. She had only their cruel yield of grief. Until a suspicion lifted from beneath her sorrow, grisly and ghastly.
It was a weapon. But who wages war upon all living things? Upon the very earth itself? What could possibly be won? Was it just stupidity?
Setok shook herself. She did not like such thoughts.
But this anger I feel, does it belong to the wolves? To the beasts on their forgotten thrones? No, not just them. It is the rage of every unintended victim. It is the fury of the innocents, the god whose face is not human, but life itself. She is coming.
Setok caught a host of vague shapes in the darkness now, circling, edging closer. Curious in the manner of all wolves, yet cautious, old memories left scars upon their souls, and they knew what the presence of these two-legged intruders meant for them, for their kind. They could smell her tears. Their child was in pain, and so the wolves spun their spiral ever tighter, bringing their heat, the solid truth of their existence, and they would bear fangs to any and every threat. They would, if needed, die in her stead. And she knew she deserved none of this.
How did you find me, after this long? I see you, grey-nosed mother. Was I the last one to suckle from your teats? Did I drink in all your strength until you were left with aching bones, failing muscles? I see the clouds in your eyes, but they cannot hide your love, and it is that love that breaks my heart.
Still she held out her hand. Moments later she felt that broad head rise beneath it. The warm, familiar smells of old assailed her, stinging her eyes.
You must not stay, she whispered. Where I go, you will be hunted down, killed. Listen to me. Find the last of the wild places. Hide there forevermore. Be free, my sweet ones.
She heard Kafal awaken, heard his muffled grunt of shock. Seven wolves crowded their small camp, shy as uninvited children. Her mother moved up closer, fur sliding the length of Setok's arm.
You must go, she whispered to the beast. Please.
Setok, said Kafal, they bring magic.
What?
Can't you feel the power? So harsh, so untamed. But I think, yes, I can use it. A warren, close enough the barrier feels thin as a leaf. Listen, if we run within it, I think...
I know,
she said in a croak, leaning her weight against the she-wolf, so solid, so real, so sure.
I know, Kafal, the gift they bring.
Perhaps, he said in growing excitement as he tugged aside his blankets, we can get there in time. We can save... Kafal, none of this is for you. Don't you understand anything? It's not for you.
He met her glare unblinking. The dawn was finally paling the sky, and then nodded.
Where will they lead you then? Do you know?
She turned away from his despair.
Oh, Kafal, you really are a fool. Of course we're returning to your tribe's camp. No other path is possible, not any more.
I don't understand.
I know. Never mind. It's time to leave.
Destri and Kallis scanned the south horizon, the blasted, unrelieved emptiness revealed in the toneless light of the rising sun.
Where, then,
she muttered, are my hands of fire? She turned to her two exhausted companions.
You understand, don't you? I cannot do this alone. To lead your kind, I need my own kind. I need to look into eyes little different from my own. I need to see their aches come the dawn, the sleep still in their faces. Spirits fend, I need to see them cough the night loose and then piss a steaming river.
The Kachin Chemal regarded her with their reptilian eyes, unblinking, unhuman. Kalith's beseeching frustration trickled away, and she fixed her attention on Sag Churok, wondering what he had seen, those 14 undead Jaghut. A battle that, it was now clear, completely eradicated their pursuers. This time, anyway. Was there something different in the Kel Hunter? Something that might be unease?
You wanted a Destriant, she snapped. If you thought that meant a doe-eyed Rodara, it must finally be clear just how wrong you were. What I am given, I intend to use. Do you understand?
Still, for all the bravado, she wished she had the power to bind those Jaghut to her will. She wished they were with them right now.
Still not human, but, well, closer. Yes, getting closer.
She snorted and turned back to study the south.
No point in waiting round here, is there? We continue on.
Destriant,
Sag Churok whispered in her mind.
We are running out of time. Our enemy draws ever closer. No, not hunting the three of us. They hunt the rooted, our final refuge in this world.
We're all the last of our kind, she said. And you must have realized by now, in this world and in every other, there is no such thing as refuge. The world finds you. The world hunts you down.
Time once more to ride Gunth Mak, as if she were nothing more than a beast, Sag Churok lumbering at their side, massive iron blades catching glares from the sun in blinding spasms. To watch small creatures start from the knotted grasses and bound away in panic, plunging through clouds of midges driven apart by the prows of reptilian heads and broad heaving chests. To feel the wind's touch as if it was a stranger's caress, startling in its unwelcome familiarity, reminding her again and again that she still lived, that she was part of the world's meat, forever fighting the decay dogging its trail. None of it seemed real, as if she was simply waiting for reality to catch up to her. Each day delivered the same message, and each day she met it with the same bemused confusion and diffident wariness. These Kachin Chemal felt none of that, she believed. They did not think as she did. Everything was a taste, a smell, thoughts and feelings, the sun's very light, all flowing in a swarm of currents. Existence was an ocean. One could skate upon the surface, clinging to the shallows, or one could plunge into the depths until the skull creaked with the pressure. She knew they saw her and her kind as timid, frightened by the mystery of unplumbed depths. Creatures floundering in fears, terrified of drowning knee-deep in truths.
But your matron wants you to slide into the shallows, to find my world of vulnerabilities, to find out what we do to defeat them. You seek new strategies for living. You seek our secret of success. But you don't understand, do you? Our secret is annihilation. We annihilate everyone else until none are left, and then we annihilate each other, until we too are gone.
Such a wondrous secret. Well, she would give it to them, if she could. Her grand lessons of survival, and only she would hear the clamoring howl of the ghosts storming her soul. Riding Gunth Mak's back, Kalith's hands itched. Destinies were drawing close.
I will find my hands of fire, and we will use you, Sag Churok. You and Gunth Mak and all your kind. We will show you the horrors of the modern world you so want to be a part of.
She thought of their dread enemy, the faceless killers of the Kachin Chemal. She wondered at this genocidal war, and suspected it was, in its essence, no different from the war humans had been engaged in for all time.
It is the same. but it is also different. It is naive. With what was coming, with what she would bring, Calith felt a deep, sickening stab of pity. In an unbroken line from each mother to every daughter, memory survived, perpetuating a continuous history of experience. Gunth Mac held in her mind generations of lives trapped in a succession of settings that portrayed the inexorable collapse, the decay, the failure of their civilization. This was unbearable. Knowledge was an unceasing scream in her soul. Every matron was eventually driven insane. No daughter, upon ascension to the role, could long withstand the deluge. Male Kachain Chemal had no comprehension of this. Their lives were perfectly contained, the flavors of their selves truncated and unsubtle. Their unswerving loyalty was sustained in ignorance. She had sought to break this pattern with Sag Churok, and in so doing was betraying the inviolate isolation of the matrons. But she did not care. All that had gone before had not worked. She remembered half a continent pounded level and then made smooth as a frozen lake, on which cities sprawled in a scale distorted even to Kachain Chemal eyes, as if grandeur and madness were one and the same. Domes large enough to swallow islands, curling towers and spires like the spikes riding the backs of Denrabi. Buildings with single rooms so huge that clouds formed beneath the ceiling, and birds dwelt there in their thousands, oblivious to the cage that held them. She remembered entire mountain ranges preserved as if they were works of art, at least until their value as quarries for skykeeps was realized in the times of the civil wars, when those mountains were carved down to stumps. She remembered looking upon her kind in league-wide columns 20 leagues long as they set out to found new colonies. She stood, creaking beneath her own weight, and watched as 50 legions of Vegath soldiers, each one 5,000 strong, marched to wage war against the Tarthano Tel Achai. And she was there when they returned, decimated, leaving a trail of their own dead that stretched across the entire continent. She recalled the birth pains of the Naruk, and then the searing agony of their betrayal, burning cities and corpses 3 deep on vast fields of battle, chaos and terror within the nests, the shriek of desperate births, and the sly mockery of the waves on the shores as a dying matron loosed her eggs into the surf in the mad hope that something new would be made, a hybrid of virtues with all the flaws discarded. And so much more. Fleeing through darkness and blinding smoke, the slash of an assassin's talons, cold, sudden adjudication, life draining away, the blessed relief that followed, flavors awakening cruel and bitter in the daughter who followed, for nothing was lost, nothing was ever lost. There was a goddess of the Kachain Chemal, immortal, omniscient as such things were supposed to be. The goddess was the matron, Mahaib of the Eternal Oil. Once, that oil had been of such strength and volume that hundreds of matrons were needed as holy vessels. Now there was but one. She could remember the pride, the power of what had once been, and the futile wars waged to give proof to that pride and that power, until both had been utterly obliterated, cities gone, the birth of wastelands across half the world. Gunth Mac knew that Gorul still lived. She knew, too, that the Shigal assassin was her adjudicator. Beyond this quest, there waited the moment of inheritance, when Asil finally surrendered to death. Was Gunth Mac a worthy successor? The Shigal would decide. Even the enemy upon the rooted, slaughter unleashed in the corridors and chambers, would have no bearing upon matters. She would surge through the panicked crowds, seeking somewhere to hide, with 3 assassins stalking her. The will to live was the sweetest flavor of all. She carried the destriant on her back, a woman who weighed virtually nothing, and Gunth Mac could feel the tension in her small muscles, her frail frame of bones. Even an orphan bears its fangs in its last moments of life. Failure in this quest was unacceptable, but in Gunth Mac's mind, it was also inevitable.
She would be the last matron, and with her death so too would die the goddess of the Kachane Jemal. The oil would drain into the dust, and all memory would be lost. It was just as well.
Spirits of stone, what happened here?
Scepter Irkullus slowly dismounted, staring aghast at the half-buried battlefield, as if the ground had lifted up to swallow them all, Bargast and Akrinai both. Crushed bodies, broken limbs, faces scoured away as if blasted by a sandstorm. Others looked bloated, skin split and cracked open, as if the poor soldiers had been cooked from within. Crows and vultures scampered about in frustrated cacophony, picking clean what wasn't buried, whilst Akrinai warriors wandered the buried valley, tugging free the corpses of dead kin. Irkullus knew his daughter's body was here somewhere. The thought clenched in his stomach like a sickly knot leeching poison, weakening his limbs, tightening the breath in his throat. He dreaded the notion of sleep at this day's end, the stalking return of anguish and despair. He would lie chilled beneath furs, chest aching, rushes of nausea squirming through him, his every breath harsh and strained, close to the clutch of panic. Something unexpected, something unknown, had come to this petty war. As if the spirits of the earth and rock were convulsing in rage and perhaps disgust.
Demanding peace. Yes, this is what the spirits have told me, with this here, this horror. They have had enough of our stupid bloodletting. We must make peace with the Bargast.
He felt old, exhausted. A day ago, vengeance seemed bright and pure. Retribution was sharp as a freshly honed knife. Four major battles, four successive victories. The Bargast clans were scattered, fleeing. Indeed, only one remained, the southernmost, largest clan, the Sanan, ruled by the one named Onos Tulan. The Akrinai had three armies converging upon the war leader and his encampment.
We have wagons creaking beneath Bargast weapons and armor, chests filled with foreign coins, heaps of strange furs, trinkets, jewelry, woven rugs, gourd bowls and clumsy pots of barely tempered clay. We have everything the Bargast possessed. Just the bodies that owned them have been removed, barring a score of broken prisoners. We are a travelling museum of a people about to become extinct. And yet I will plead for peace.
Upon hearing this, his officers would frown behind his back, thinking him an old man with a broken heart, and they would be right to think that. They would accept his commands, but this would be the last time. Once they rode home, Scepter Irkullus would be seen, would be known to all, as a ruler in his grey dusk. A man with no light of the future in his eyes, a man awaiting death.
But it comes to us all. Everything we fear comes to us all.
Gafalk, who had been among the advance party, rode up and reined in near the scepter's own horse. The warrior dismounted and walked to stand in front of Irkullus.
Scepter, we have examined the western ridge of the valley, or what's left of it. Old Yara, he continued, speaking of the Bargast spokesperson among the prisoners, says he once fought outside some place called One Eye Cat. He says the craters remind him of something called Maranth munitions, but not when those munitions are dropped from the sky, as was done by the Maranth. Instead, the craters look like those made when the munitions are used by the Malazans, buried in the ground, arranged to ignite all at once, thus lifting the ground itself. Some kind of grenado. He called them cussers.
We know there is a Malazan army in Lether,
Irkullus said, musing. Then he shook his head.
Give me a reason for their being here, joining in a battle not of their making, killing both Akrinai and Bargast.
The Bargast were once enemies of these Malazans, Scepter. So claims Yara.
Yet have our scouts seen signs of their forces? Do any trails lead from this place? No. Are the Malazans ghosts, Gafalk?
The warrior spread his hands in helpless dismay.
Then what struck here, Scepter?
The rage of gods. Sorcery.
A sudden flicker in Gafalk's eyes.
Lethary, who might well be pleased to see the Akronai and Bargast destroy each other.
It is said the Malazans left them few mages, Scepter, and their new cedar is an old man who is also the Chancellor, not one to lead an army.
But Irkullus was already shaking his head at his own suggestions.
Even a Lethary cedar cannot hide an entire army. You are right to be skeptical, Gafalk.
A conversation doomed to circle round and devour its own tail. Irkullus stepped past the warrior and looked upon the obliterated valley once more.
Dig out as many of our warriors as you can. At dusk we cease all such efforts, leaving the rest to the earth. We shall drive back the night with the power of our dead, and I shall stand vigil.
Yes, Scepter.
The warrior returned to his horse.
Vigil, yes, that will do.
A night without sleep, he would let the bright flames drive back the sickness in his soul. It would be best, he decided, if he did not survive to return home. An uncle or cousin could play the bear to his grandchildren, someone else in any case. Better, indeed, if he was denied the chance of sleep until the very instant of his death.
One final battle against the Sinan camp. Kill them all and then fall myself. Bleed out in the red mud. And once dead, I can make my peace with their ghosts. Hardly worth continuing this damned war on the ash plains of death, this stupid thing. Dear daughter, you will not wander alone for long, I swear it. I will find your ghost, and I will protect you forevermore, as penance for my failure, and as proof of my love.
He glared about, as if in the day's fading light he might see her floating spirit, a wraith with a dirt-smeared face and disbelieving eyes. No, eyes with the patience of the eternally freed.
Freed from all this, freed from everything. In a new place, where no sickness grows inside, where the body does not clench and writhe, flinching at the siren calls of every twinge, every ache. Spirits of stone, give me peace.
Maral Eb's army had doubled in size, as survivors from shattered encampments staggered in from all directions. Shame-faced at living when wives, husbands, and children had died beneath the iron of the treacherous Akronai. Many arrived bearing no weapons, shorn of armor, proof that they had been routed, had fled in waves of wide-eyed cowardice. Cold waters were known to wash upon warriors in the midst of battle, even Bargast warriors, and the tug of currents could lift into a raging flood where all reason drowned, where escape was a need that overwhelmed duty and honor. Cold waters left the faces of the survivors grey and bloated, stinking of guilt. But Maral Eb had been sobered enough by the news of the defeat to cast no righteous judgment upon these refugees with their skittish eyes. Clearly, he understood he would need every warrior he could muster, although Bakal knew as well as anyone how such warriors, once drowned beneath panic, were now broken inside. Worse, in the instant when a battle tottered on the fulcrum's point, their terror could return. They could doom the battle as their panic flooded out and infected everyone else. No word had come from the Sinan. It seemed that, thus far at least, the Akronai had yet to descend upon Bakal's own clan. Soon Maral Eb would grasp hold of the Sinan army and claim it for himself, and then he would lead them all against the deceitful Scepter Irkullus. A thousand curses rode the breaths of the mass of warriors. It was obvious now that the Akrin had been planning this war for some time, trickling in and out their so-called merchants as spies, working towards the perfect moment for betrayal. How else could the Scepter assemble such forces so quickly? For every refugee insisted that the enemy numbered in the tens of thousands. Bakal believed none of it. This was the war Onos Tulan did not want, the wrong war. Mar-al-Eb walked flanked by his two brothers, and surrounding these three was a mob of strutting idiots, each one vying to find the perfect words to please their new war leader and his two hood-eyed, murderous siblings. Arguments sending the arrow of blame winging away. Onos Tulan was no longer alive, and so less useful as a target, although some murky residue remained, like handfuls of shit awaiting any rivals among the Sinan. Now it was the Akrenai, Irkullus and his lying, cheating, spying horsemongers. By the time this army arrived at the Sinan camp, they would be blazing with the righteous fury of innocent victims.
"Whatever he needs," Strahl had said at the noon break. "Falsehoods cease being false when enough people believe them, Bakal. Instead, they blaze like eternal truths, and woe to the fool who tries pissing a stream on that. They'll tear you to pieces."
Strahl's words were sound, ringing clear and true upon the anvil, leaving Bakal's disgust to chew him on the inside with no way out. That ache warred with the one in his barely mended elbow, making his stride stiff and awkward. But neither one could assail the shame and self-hatred that closed a fist round his soul.
"Murderer of Onos Tulan. So fierce the thrust that he broke his arm. Look upon him, friends, and see a true white-faced Bargast."
He had heard as much from Mar-al-Eb's cronies, while behind him trudged his fellow Sinan warriors, nothing like the triumphant slayers of Onos Tulan they pretended to be, silent, grim as shoulder women at a funeral.
"Because we share this crime. He made us kill him to save our own lives. He made us cowards. He made me a coward."
Bakal felt like an old man, and each time his gaze caught upon those three broad backs arrayed like bone-picker birds at the head of the trail, it was another white-hot stone tossed into the cauldron, soon to boil, yes, raging until the blackened pot boiled dry.
"All that useless steam. What will you do with my people, Mar-al-Eb? When Irkullus shatters us again, where will we run to?"
He needed to think. He needed to find a way out of this. Could he and his warriors convince the rest of the clan to refuse Mar-al-Eb? Refuse this suicidal war? Teeth grating, Bakal began to understand the burdens under which Onos Tulan had labored, the impossibility of things.
"The real war is against stupidity. How could I not have understood that? Oh, an easy answer to that question. I was among the stupidest of the lot. And yet, Onos Tulan, you stood before me and met my eyes. You gave me what I did not deserve. And look at me now. When Mar-al-Eb stands before me, I choke at the very sight of him. His flush of triumph, his smirk, the drunken eyes. I am ready to spew into his face. And if I had any food in my guts, I would probably do just that, unable to help myself. Onos Tulan, you should have killed us. Every warrior you brought with you. Be done with the stupid ones. Be done with us all. Instead, you leave us with the perfect legacy of our idiocy. Mar-al-Eb, precisely the leader we deserve. And for our misplaced faith, he will kill everyone."
Bakal bared his teeth until the wind dried them like sun-baked stones. He would do nothing. He would defy even Strahl and his companions here. There would be justice after all, an ocean of it to feed the thirsty ground. So long as he did nothing, said nothing.
"Lead us, Mar-al-Eb. You are become the standard of Tul's truth. You are his warning to us, which we refuse to heed. So, warrior of the Imas, you shall have your vengeance after all."
Strahl spoke at his side.
"I have seen such smiles, friend, upon the warrior I am about to slay. The brave ones who face their deaths unflinching. I see crazed contempt, as if they say to me, 'Do what you must, you cannot reach me. My flesh, yes, my life, but not my soul. Drive home your blade, warrior. The final joke is on you.'
His laugh was a low snarl. And so it is, because it is a joke I will not get until I am in their place, facing down my own death.
Then, said Bakal, you will have to wait, but not for long. And when the time comes, I too will laugh at this perfect jest.
The place belonged to Stallman, but it was his wife who walked at the head of the Gadra column. And it was to Sakara the Vile that the scouts reported during the long march to the Sanan encampment, which was now less than half a league away. Her husband's face was set in a scowl as he trudged 3 paces behind her. The expression did not belong to offended fury, however. Confusion and fear were the sources of his anger, the befuddled misery of the unintelligent man. Things were moving too fast. Essential details were being kept from him. He did not understand, and this made him frightened. He had right to be. Sakara was beginning to realize that his usefulness was coming to an end. Oh, there were advantages to ruling through him, should that opportunity arise in the aftermath of the imminent power struggle, but better a husband who actually comprehended his titular function, assuming it was even necessary, since many a past war leader had been a woman. Although, truth be said, such women were invariably warriors, possessing the status of experienced campaigners. Sakara had fought many battles, of course, in her own style. She had laid sieges in tents and in yurts. She had drawn blood beneath the furs in the armor of night, had driven knives, figurative and literal, into the hearts of scores of lovers. She had unleashed precision ambushes with utter ruthlessness, and had stared down seemingly insurmountable odds. Her list of triumphs was well nigh unending. But few would countenance any of that. They held to out-of-fashion notions of prowess and glory, and for Sakara this had proved, and would ever prove, the greatest obstacle to her ascension. No, for now she would need a man to prop up in front of her. Not that anyone would be fooled, but so long as propriety was observed, they would abide. There were challenges ahead. Stallman was not ready to be the war leader of the White Faces. Not while in the throes of a vicious war. No, at the moment, the greatest need was to ensure the survival of the Barghast, and that demanded a capable commander. Someone clever in the ways of tactics and whatnot. Someone swollen with ambition, eager to be quickly pushed to the fore, arriving breathless and flush. Quickly, yes, so that he'd no opportunity to grow wary, to begin to recognize the flimsy supports beneath him, the clever traps awaiting his first misstep. Sakara had long pondered prospective candidates, and she had to admit that she was not entirely satisfied with her final choice. But the bones were cast. Alone, in the chill night at that first secret meeting, in the wake of a tumultuous gathering of war chiefs, Maral Ebb had seemed perfect. His contempt for Onos Tulan had filled him with hatred that she slyly fed until it became a kind of fevered madness. Nothing difficult there, and his willingness to bind himself to her conspiracy had struck her, at the time, as almost comical, like a puppy eager to lick whatever she offered. He had been alone, and perhaps in that she had been careless. She had not considered, for even an instant, Maral Ebb's 2 brothers. 3 were harder to manage than 1, almost impossible, in fact. If they were left to consolidate their domination once the war was over, Sakara knew that her chance would be forever lost. She knew indeed that Maral Ebb would see her murdered to silence all that she knew. Well, his brothers would just have to die. In battle, to a stray arrow, these things, she had been told, happened all the time. Or some bad food, improperly cured, to strike with swift fever and terrible convulsions until the heart burst. A lover's tryst gone awry, some enraged rival. Charges of rape, a trial of shaming and a sentence of castration. Oh, the possibilities were countless. For the moment, of course, such delights would have to wait. The Akronai must be defeated first, or at least driven back. One more battle awaited them, and this time Scepter Irkullus would be facing the combined might of the Sanan, Baran, and Gadra clans. 2 Baran scouts had found her 3 days past, carrying with them the stunning news of Onos Tulan's murder. The Gadra had already been on the march. Sakara had made certain that her people, a small clan, isolated and perilously close to Akrin lands, had not awaited the descent of thousands of enraged Akrinai horse warriors. Instead, Stallman had announced the breaking of camp, and this fast-paced retreat to the safety of the Sanan almost as soon as news of the war reached them. Since then, Gadra scouts had twice sighted distant riders observing them, but nothing more, and as Sakara learned from an alarmingly steady arrival of refugees from other clans, a half-dozen battles had left the Bargast reeling. The sudden coyness of the victorious Akrinai was disturbing. Unless they too sought one final clash, one that they were content to let the Gadra lead them to at a steady dog-trot. Stallman complained that his warriors were weary, barely fit for battle. Their nerves were twisted into taut knots by constant vigilance and a sickening sense of vulnerability. They were a small clan, after all. It made no tactical sense for the Scepter to let them reach the Sanan. The Akrinai horde should have washed over them by now. Well, that was for Mar-al-Eb to worry about. Sakara had just this morning sent her own agents ahead to the Sanan. Onos Tulan was dead, but his wife was not, nor his children, bloodkin and otherwise. The time had come for Sakara to unleash her long-awaited vengeance. The day's light was fading. Though she had exhorted her people with relentless impatience, they would not reach the Sanan any time before midnight. And by then, the blood spilled would be as cold as the ground beneath it.